man was not bad. I have nothing against it. But I would have liked him to marry a Dravidian untouchable. A Dravidian Harijan, what they call him. Like himself. And she should have married a Frenchman, an Alsatian, or a German. She was a German herself. But because they were Catholics, they got married. If they had not been Christians at all, if he had been the worshipper of Mariamma, Mariamma is the mother goddess of South India, one of the numerous mother goddesses of South India. Supposing he had been that, nothing else. Worshipper of Mariamma. And she, a worshipper of Votan. Like in antiquity, they never would have come together. There you are. That is the advantage of these national creeds. They keep you each one in its place. And when they don't, well, sex is an exception. Or else the two people are very near each other. You had, for instance, probably intermarriages between people who worshipped Tor in antiquity and Slavs. How did the Poles come? Poles are some Slavs with a mixture of German. They are not pure Slav. And so many Russians are not pure Slav either. The Russians, the ancestors of the Russians before Christianity, they worshipped another one with a hammer also and four heads, Perun. Perun and Tor got on very well together. They were neighbors. They symbolized the same thing. Well, why not? They were brothers. They were very near in race. And of course, you had these Gauls marrying Germans in the Merovingian days. Before the Gauls became Christians, they had their own gods. They had some international gods, cosmic gods, the sun and the moon, naturally. The sun and the moon. There's a lovely little dialogue in a French tale, short story of Anatole France. Or was it Anatole France? Yes, Anatole France. Of a Gaul that followed Caesar to England. And they're both coming back. And the Gaul saw with his own eyes the shattering to pieces of the Roman fleet and the coasts of England due to tide. And he knows the moon governs the tide. And he tells Caesar on his way back, he tells Caesar, you see, the moon is a very powerful goddess and she loves the Gauls. She's on the Gaulish side. And Caesar laughs and says, well, the moon, everybody considers the moon as a goddess. We do, the Greeks do, everybody does. Even the Carthaginians did. And that moon, you say she loves the Gauls, but she's now shining over Rome. And the Gaul looks at him and says, shining over Rome, is it the moon? It must be a different moon. The national spirit, that I would say that real tribal spirit, it might look rather naive to a person that lives in the 20th century. But it has its advantages. It has its advantages. The Gauls very quickly married Romans, even the Gallo-Romans. But some of them also married Germanic people. All the north of France is Germanic. And I'd like to point out that not only the north of France, but all the aristocracies of Europe, all the kings and queens of Europe, from the early days, are all Germanic. Even the Russians. Who was Ulrich? Ulrich was German, or the Swede, it's the same thing. Who were the rulers of Italy? Well, the German emperors, of course. Who were the rulers of France? The Merovingians, the Carolingians, and the other ones. They were all descended from Germans, from Franks. That conquered France. France is called France because of the Franks. And the Franks are Germans. They were Christians. That was their downfall. That is to say, they did not stay purely Germanic because they were Christians. They shouldn't have married people from south of Europe. They should have remained north Europe. And you have some of the greatest emperors of Germany that married foreigners. For instance, Otto II. Otto II married Theophano, the daughter of Romanos II of Byzantium, the sister of Basilius, the exterminator of the Bulgarians, as they call him, Basilius II, his very sister. His other sister, Anne, married the recently Christianized Russian, Vladimir. And Russia became Christian, officially at least, from that day. It's this, the sign of Christianity is in the beginning, in the marriage. And I don't like that. Of course, I know there are some National Socialist groups in the USA, like this Sword of Christ group in Arkansas. I think it's Arkansas. Arkansas. That tell you the Bible doesn't encourage interbreeding. The Bible doesn't encourage it, perhaps. It doesn't encourage interbreeding of Jews with non-Jews, religiously. But it wouldn't mind, it doesn't mind a Jew marrying a Semite that has converted herself or himself to Christianity, to Judaism. And you get converts to Judaism in the days of Christ and afterwards. Who was Timothy? Half Greek, half Jew. And there were many of these fearing, God-fearing people. They called them in the Bible, in the New Testament, God-fearing. They were half Jew, half Greek, or proselytes, people that were living near the synagogue, that were not circumcised, but still worshipped Yahweh. That was, and this, all this prepared Christianity. The rise of Judah as a great, powerful political factor, and cultural factor, unfortunately. A religious factor in the world doesn't date from Christianity. It dates from the 4th century BC, from Alexandria. And the proof of it is that you have Jews of the 3rd century BC with Greek names, like this Aristobulus, he's a Greek name, he's a Jew, who dare to write in those days, long before Christianity, that all the marvels, all the good things of Greek philosophy really come from Judaism. They come from Moses, Pythagoras, Plato, all these great thinkers of Greece. They were influenced by the Jewish scriptures, so Aristobulus says. Of course, it's not true. And after that, you get these, the pseudo-Aristeos, you get so many other writers, and you get Philon. Philon the Jew. Philon the Jew, who is one of the first ones to speak of the Logos, the verb, incarnate verb, that is going to become the second person of the Trinity in Christianity. He's preparing the way for Christianity without knowing it. And who goes with a Jewish delegation when he's, I don't know how old, but not far from 100. Under Caligula in Rome, he goes to Rome. And what does he go to Rome for? To ask the Roman emperor to dismiss Flaccus, governor, Roman governor of Egypt. Why? Because Flaccus says that the Jews are no citizens of Egypt. They are something different. This said, Flaccus said, in other words, what our Führer said also. Our Führer said the Jews are not no Germans. Point four of the 24 points, 25th by 5 points. Flaccus said the same. Said the Jews are a people apart. They have nothing to do with average Egyptians. I'm the governor of Egypt. I'm not the governor of the Jews. They must be considered as foreigners. They must have treatment as guests, as foreigners. And for that, Flaccus was dismissed by Caligula. The same attitude in those days as now. They don't want to be called foreigners, but among themselves, they are foreigners. And it is quite sufficient for an English Jew or an American Jew, or we should say a Jew from England, a Jew from America, to sit in a seat on one of the El Al planes, he's automatically a Jewish citizen. He lands, no trouble. No trouble at all. But when he's in France, he says, I'm French. When he's in Canada, he says, I'm a Canadian. When he's in the USA, he says, I'm an American. But he gives one-tenth of his income to Israel. He's a perfect, he's logical. He does what he can to get off and to get on in the interests of his race. We should imitate them in that way. We should be as logical and as efficient in the defense and in the supporting of our Aryan race as they are in of us. Then there would be no Jewish Christian, no Christian. That's what I have to say about Christianity. I'm not against it. I don't want anybody, I don't want to say that I would like to bring people away from it. If they have nothing else, let them have it. But I think, on principle, it's incompatible. With, not with National Socialism only, but with any attitude centered on race, centered on nation and race. It, in order to become a nationalist, to be a nationalist and a Christian, you have to distort Christianity. You have to consider it as a national religion, what the Irish do, the Poles do, in spite of communism, the Spanish do. In that way, they are all right. Nothing will happen to them. But it is due to a misunderstanding of the spirit of Christianity. Of the spirit of Christianity as it has come to us. Through the legend of Christ, perhaps not through the historical Christ. If it is true, I don't say it is, but some people think it is, if it is true that the historical Christ was really a Jewish nationalist fighting the Romans. You see, I think that another thing I have against Christianity is that it was not taken freely by Europe. It was imposed on us. It was the fault of our princes for different reasons that have nothing to do with religion. Constantine became a Christian in 1313. Before him, 10 years before, Tigran II, king of Armenia, became a Christian also. And aren't the Armenians proud of that? We are the first Christian nation, so they say. That is to say, Tigran II was the first Christian king. I don't know if the Armenians followed him or not at once. Certainly, the Greeks did not follow Constantine at once. There were Christian communities already all over the Roman Empire. There were other communities too. Mitra communities, Cybele, Cybele, goddess, mother goddess of Asia Minor. She had many followers too. And these religions, these other religions, were called religions of salvation. They had the idea of a god put to death and resurrected, risen from the dead, for the salvation of mankind. The idea that you had in Adonis also, and in Osiris, and in Tammuz, in those gods of Egypt, of Syria, of Egypt, and of Babylonia. In fact, the very words that are attributed to Christ at the moment of the consecration of the bread and wine, he who does not eat my flesh and drink my blood has no salvation, something like that, has no eternal life. We have the exact replica in the cult of Mitra 1400 years before. He who does not eat my flesh and drink my blood has no eternal life. And this was discovered by Tertullian, the Christian father of the Latin Church, in the second century. And Tertullian, of course, found an explanation. He had to find an explanation. How is it that Christ and Mitra speak the same language? He said, oh no, that's not the fact. Christ is right. But the devil put these words into the cult of Mitra 1400 years before, out of mockery of what was going to be one day Christianity. The devil did it. That's an explanation. But it's no explanation in my eyes anyhow. The fact is that Europe did not become Christian at once. First of all, why did Constantine become a Christian? His life was nothing Christian-like. Absolutely nothing. He had his wife killed on simple suspicion of adultery, not proof. He had his own son killed. He had so many people killed. Not Christian. But he was a Roman emperor. And he wanted the unity of the Roman Empire. Unity of blood, there was none. Unity of language, there was none. And there could be none. There was a unity, there could have been a unity in the worship of the emperor, but the worship of the emperor only interested the Romans. It didn't interest the Syrians a bit. It didn't interest even the Greeks. I wonder if the Greeks did not even resent a temple to the goddess Rome on the Acropolis. There is a temple of the goddess Rome on the Acropolis of Athens. A round temple, the ruins are there still. I don't know how the Athenians liked it. Anyhow, there was no unity. The only unity that could be was a unity of faith. Now, there were several faiths of salvation. Why didn't Constantine take Mitra? Mitra was already very, very well widespread among the Roman soldiers. Even some emperors later on were going to be worshippers of Mitra, the Aryan god, Sol Invictus, the invincible sun, represented by a man with a Phrygian cap and a bull sacrifice. Well, the religion of Mitra would have taken centuries to spread, because the priests of Mitra were no fanatics. They didn't say, outside the cult of Mitra, you are all damned. They never said that. It would have taken centuries. The cult of Sivari also. Any cult except Christianity would have taken centuries to make the cultural and religious unity of the empire. And even Christianity took centuries. But at least under Constantine, the Mediterranean, there was a hope that within a few decades, officially, the Mediterranean would be Christian. And that was the fact. It was imposed. There is no manuscript of any of the canonical Gospels, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. No manuscript of them older than the 4th or 5th century. What was there before? Other Gospels, apocryphal, of which there are pieces to be found now and then, and some of them quite different from the canonical Gospels. What happened to the originals? They were collected from all the churches under Constantine, under the supervision of Eusebius of Caesarea, the great court historiographer and bishop, and they were collected by batches of 50, and new batches of 50 of the Gospels we know today were sent out to the churches. There were very, very many alterations in them for the Roman Empire to have one faith. And then, of course, there were places, the crosses of Christ were found by Helena, Constantine's mother. She dug somewhere in Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem was completely destroyed by Titus in the year 70, so much so that there was no trace, according to Flavius Josephus, no trace of its streets. One didn't know what were before. It was completely flat. It was reconstructed afterwards, slowly. In the 4th century, the emperor's mother, Helena, who was a Christian, has it dug somewhere in Jerusalem, and found three crosses, wooden crosses, intact. How did they stay in there? Although the land is dry, I admit the land is dry in Palestine, but 300 years after the crucifixion, three crosses absolutely intact. That's funny. They put a dead man on each one, and when they put him on the cross, it was Christ's cross, the dead man became alive again, so they say. That's how they found the real cross. And when you go to Jerusalem as a pilgrim, you can buy a piece of the real cross. There are so many pieces of the real cross to be sold that if they were all genuine, the cross would have kilometers long and kilometers wide. Anyhow, that was Christianity for the Mediterranean people. No jobs of high significance unless you are a Christian. Constantine. And then came Theodosius. Long after Constantine, you have in between the attempt of Emperor Julian to re-give a chance to paganism, to Greco-Latin paganism, Unfortunately, that failed. That failed in the year 363. He only ruled from 360 to 363, Julian. He was probably murdered on the battlefield because he received a spear from behind. And they said it was a barbarian captive that they sent them. When were barbarian captives taken into cavalry charges and given spears in their hands? It's a story. He was murdered probably by some Christian. Anyhow, after him, the Christianity was again religion of the empire. Comes the Emperor Theodosius, who died in 395. He did away with the philosophical schools. No, with the temples. He shut the temples. He forbade, as much as he could forbid, he forbade Delphi. Already in Julian's days, Delphi was an abandoned place, the Oracle of Delphi. Now, in the 6th century, under Justinian, the last philosophical schools were forbidden, the Greek philosophical schools. You were not to teach anything but Christianity. Antiquity was forbidden. Naturally, it continued on the slow. There were still worshippers of the old gods, they say, in Greece, in the 14th and 15th century. In the days where Prussia, the land of Frederick the Great, land of Bismarck, was still pagan, Prussians were Christianized in the 14th and 15th century, and so were the Lithuanians. They were pagans. Scandinavia was Christianized in the 11th century under Olaf II of Norway and Eric of Sweden. They were Christianized by fire and sword, just as Germany was under Charlemagne. Charlemagne fought the Saxons for 30 years to make them Christians by force. Widukind defended Germany and defended the old faith. He was vanquished. Well, the Franks were better organized. They had better weapons. They were efficient as warriors. And they were perhaps more united. They had the schooling of the Romans. They were very much in touch with the Romans. In fact, they speak of a project of marriage between Charlemagne and the Empress Irene of the Roman Empire, of Constantinople, of the Eastern Roman Empire. It didn't come through anyhow. But the Germans were Christianized by fire and sword. In 782, 4,500 German chiefs were put to death, beheaded one after the other, after a solemn mass and lot of pomp on the borders of the Aller at Verden in North Germany, because they didn't want to take the new faith. They refused it. They were all beheaded. The river Aller must have been red with blood. That was 1782. 772, 10 years before, the old high place of the sun for all North Europe, not for Germany alone, the Externstein, was stormed by Charlemagne, and the sunroom destroyed. The roof was blown off. He had no dynamite, of course, but he put ice in a kind of little place. He dug a place all around it and put water there. It was in the middle of December, the water became ice. Ice is bigger than fancy. It takes more volume than water. Off the place, the place was shut off, the roof was shut off. You can see the ruins of it now. And in 785, you have from Paderborn the famous Capitularia of Paderborn, the rules and regulations that Charlemagne imposed on Germany, or on the part of Germany he had conquered. He didn't conquer the east of Germany, of course. Whoever runs away into the woods in order not to be christened is to die by death, penalty of death. Whoever burns his dead relatives instead of burying them, according to Christian new rule, is to die of death, because of death penalty. Whoever reads runic scriptures is to be killed. Whoever listens to runic teaching is to be killed. There's a list like that of I don't know how many things that you mustn't do. Whoever refuses to do this or refuses to do that, whoever doesn't have his children christened, penalty of death. That's how Germany was Christianized. That's how Scandinavia was Christianized. That's how, in fact, all the countries of the north of Europe were Christianized. Christianity was not liked by the Nordic race. Nordic race didn't like it. There were certainly things in the Bible that shocked them. Well, even if you know nothing else, the story of Lot and his daughters, that was shocking enough. And then the polygamy of the old Semites. The Nordic races, by tradition, monogamous. They probably didn't like that. There were so many things. And then, of course, stories like that one I told you the other day, of Jael killing her enemy during his sleep. That was so anti-Aryan, so shocking. How could they accept that? The result was that the Catholic Church very wisely forbade the faithful from reading the Bible. It was not allowed to read the Bible in the Middle Ages. Of course it was not allowed. I can understand the Catholic Church. And what I cannot understand is when the Bible was allowed to be read after Luther, after the Reformation, how did people remain Christian? It's the Bible that may put me against the jury. It's not anything else. It's not Mein Kampf. I didn't know Mein Kampf in those days. But when I was a child and made to read the Old Testament and the New Testament by my pious aunt, there were so many things that shocked me. And that's what I have to say. Christianity was not taken by Europe spontaneously, at least not by the Nordic race. And even the Mediterranean people, they had their own beliefs. They had their own superstitions. They carried their superstitions into Christianity. There's nothing more superstitious as a Southern European, even today, among the masses. They replaced the cult of the Marian cult, the cult of the Virgin Mary, is nothing but the cult of the Great Mother of Antiquity, transposed. They stuck to it. They gave it another name. That's all. They made Christianity according to themselves. But what is awful is that it is a religion that inherited from its Jewish origin intolerance, the typical Jewish conduct. Although the Jews never did these things, because their policy was not conversion or death, but death in any case, if you are not a Jew, and if you are not stand in the way of the expansion of Jewry, like the Canaanites. In Europe, it was not that. You can save your life by becoming a Christian. If you don't want to become one, or if you work against it in the Middle Ages, it's a stake. You're burnt at the stake. So many people were. So many people were. It was not done in the Greek Church. I must say, to be just, in the Orthodox Church, you have no burnings. You get it in the Catholic Church, you get it in the Protestant Church. And nobody, one is as good as the other. They both did it. Some weren't Catholics, others weren't Protestants. Or heretics, or whatever you like. You have the awful story of the Cathars in south of France, early 13th century. Now, reincarnation is one of the two only beliefs that unite all Hindus of any caste, from the Brahmin to the untouchable. It is to say the Harijan, they call them Harijan. It is to say people of God, but every creature is a person of God. So it doesn't mean anything. The outcast, the lowest outcast, generally the Aborigines. What is a Harijan? He's either an Aborigines or else he's a man of any caste who has done something awful, or whose ancestors rather have done something awful. He was outcasted. And when you are outcasted in India, your descendants are outcasted also for all times to come. From the toppest Brahmin to the lowest Harisha, everybody believes in reincarnation. That is to say, there is in every living creature, not in every man. Reincarnation is for animals and plants also, not only for people. There is in every living creature a visible body, one or more than one subtle body, and these subtle bodies separate from the rest, from the physical body at time of death. And they constitute what they call the ego. That ego, if it is not already merged into the universal ego, that is to say, if the man is not, what the Hindus say, liberated, that ego takes a new birth in some other body, animal or human, or plant. Plants live. Even minerals have some kind of life. There's nothing in the world that's not absolutely, soaking in some kind of life, some kind of vibration. So, the belief is not that when you are good, you are reborn in a higher social status. That's nonsense. You are not reborn rich. If you are poor, you wish to be rich. If you are good, you don't become rich in the next life, not necessarily. It might be the contrary. It might be a rich man is reborn as a beggar. He's reborn that in that status, which will be the best for his spiritual evolution. If it is better for his spiritual evolution for him to be born in a very low social status, and a low social status does not mean in India a low race. There are Brahmin beggars, there are Aryans, and there are non-Aryans, and there are untouchables that are multimillionaires. It has nothing to do with money. And that's one of the things I like the best of Hindus. An Aryan, or supposed to be Aryan, say a Brahmin, if he is a beggar and he goes to a marriage ceremony, they put him inside at the best place, most honorable place, with the other brands. If a multimillionaire or multimilliardaire, untouchable, goes to a marriage ceremony, he'll be put outside with his fellow untouchables. He will not be given a greater, better place because he has money. Money or learning, even learning. Brajanath Seel was a scientist, a very great scientist. He was a seal, but he was a very low caste Bengal. Seals are very low caste. He was never given the greater status. Learning can be acquired. Money can be acquired. Only blood cannot be acquired. For the Hindu religion, and that's what I like in the Hindu religion, it's the only real living religion compatible with National Socialism. It gives priority to what cannot be acquired with any means. You're born with a race, you can't change your race, whatever you do. You get reborn if you are not perfect. That is to say, if you have not gone through all the experiences resulting from the algebraic sum of your good and bad deeds. Good and bad means nothing. Good is what is according to the nature of your soul, and bad is what goes against nature. That's all. You have not in Hinduism to kill your instincts. Not at all. In fact, if you go to a yogi and ask him to be your master, he puts you some questions. Among the questions there is this: how strong are your instincts? If you tell him, well, I have no instincts, perfectly neutral. He says, you're no good for a yogi. The stronger instincts you have, the better. Because the stronger means the most great energy you have. You have to take that energy upwards. You have to transform it. Well, it's this theory of Nietzsche. It's exactly the idea of Nietzsche. The Superman has not to kill his passions. He has to canalize them for a higher purpose. Dominate them. Not let them dominate him, but dominate them. That's a Hindu idea too. Now, you get reborn unless you have finished this process completely. You get reborn. Some people are not reborn, but they wish to be reborn for the good of creatures. Again, not of man, but of all creatures. And they are reborn where they want to be. They choose the race, they choose the family in which they are getting reborn, they choose their own life beforehand, and they get reborn. These are what the Buddhists call the bodhisattvas. And the others were not reborn at all, they are called arhats in the Buddhist terminology. Now, generally when you are reborn higher, you are reborn, I say not in the social status higher, but higher in race. It will take centuries and millennia for a lower race now to become an Aryan. Generally an Aryan is reborn as an Aryan. Unless he has done awful things, he might be reborn some very low. Might be reborn very low. I suppose the man who tortured Stryker, for instance, would be reborn as Negroes. It wouldn't astonish me at all. They were deserved, suddenly they do. Especially if they were Aryans. If they were Jews, not so much. If they were Jews, they would be more excusable. If they were Aryans, my goodness. Anyhow, the idea is that there is no watertight separation between man, animal, plant, or whatever it is. There's one universe and one life permeating everything. And the individual has one thing in common with the universe, and that is the Atma, what they call the Atma. Not the soul, not the ego. The ego is the totality of his subtle bodies. The Atma is something different. It is that which in him is of the same nature as the soul of the universe. The soul, there's a spark of divinity in every living creature, not only in every man. That spark of divinity, he can act as though it were non-existent, not taking any notice of it at all. Or he should, if he wants to develop spiritually, he should strive to become more and more conscious of it. And yoga is just nothing else but the science of making a person conscious of that. It consists, there are different kinds of yoga. There's Hatha yoga. Hatha yoga is what you do on your body, you act on your body. There is Karma yoga. Karma yoga is the teaching, one of the teachings of the Gita. Not only of the Gita. You get it in national sources. And I'll tell you what, Karma yoga. Karma yoga is act with your body for the interest of the universe. For the interest of the universe. According to the scheme of the universe, divine scheme. And without any passion, without any personal attachment or disgust or enthusiasm or anything. Just do it because it's duty. Act in the name of duty alone. That's Karma Yoga. Well, I was thrilled when I read a few of the writings, letters to Princess von Isenburg of Otto Ollendorf. A few letters he wrote before his death. He has that spirit. And he was the head of the Einsatzgruppe D, of the four famous Einsatzgruppen who were acting in Russia and acting in Poland especially. They were all SS men, naturally. And they show from the rules and regulations which Otto Ollendorf told his judges when he was judged by the Americans. That shows how near they were from Hinduism. Without knowing it, or with knowing it, I don't know. Probably the chiefs knew it. Otto Ollendorf said, any of us in the Einsatzgruppe, if we had very dirty work to do, mass executions, of anybody who was opposing the German army, even children, of course, if a child six can shoot and shoots, Well, we can't accept him. We can't let him live. You have that experience in the Americans in the Vietnam War. They went to some place, I was told, in North Vietnam. I was told that by an eyewitness. And they started distributing. They left their tanks. They came with their tanks. They had tanks. They left four or five tanks, or perhaps more. They came out. They distributed candies to the kiddies. Kiddies took the candies, ate them, and then, perhaps eating them still, went under the tanks. They were young communists with ideas. Brave children. I admire them. Brave children. 6, 7, 8 years old. They put what they had in their hands under the tanks, and the tanks blew up, and the children under them. They gave their lives for their cause. Well, if you catch a child like that, are you to keep it or are you to kill it? It's a powerful enemy. A convinced enemy. What could you do? The Einsatzgruppen had to do that against partisans in Russia, partisans in Poland. Partisans were harassing the Roman, the German army from right, left, behind, in front. What could they do? And the Otto Rundorf said, if any of us showed the slightest pleasure or the slightest disgust in what we did, we were degraded and sent home. That's the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita. That's what you call karma yoga. All these S-men, knowing it or not, they were karma yogis. They were getting salvation. They were mastering themselves, mastering their feelings, putting themselves in the proof, in the cause, what you call it, the alchemy, for purification by the actions. And then you have bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is yoga of devotion. You feel devoted to something. And in devotion, you hire yourself. Well, I tried hatha yoga years and years ago, 36, 37, with a South Indian Brahmin that happened to be at that time the curator of the Museum of Lahore. Lahore was India, of course. And I was teaching Jalandhar, not far away from Lahore. He taught me breathing exercises and the beginning of hatha yoga. Now, I progressed very quickly, and I reached a stage at which I felt that my body didn't exist. I had no body. I was just a column of vibrating energy, up and down, according to the respiration. And I felt I could pass through walls. No material obstacle was a real obstacle to me. And that's all. But after my exercises, I had pain behind the eyes, as though somebody was pulling my eyes from inside. And I told that to this guru of mine. And he said, if you feel that, stop. Hatha yoga is not for you. You need very strong nerves for that. Your nerves apparently are not strong enough. You get this eye trouble. Take another form of yoga. I said, what form of yoga? He said, don't you love anything? I said, yes, I do. I have a cause. Then work for your cause. Work for whatever you love. But work in detachment. Try not to feel upset if you are unsuccessful. Try not to feel pride if you are successful. If people blame you or insult you, be indifferent. If they praise you, don't feel pleased. Feel indifferent, feel all right. They praise me. Don't feel exalted if people praise you. Every praise is really not right. I mean to say it's not to the mark, because you are not perfect, you are not liberated. You have a body still. To have a body, to be born, according to a Hindu, is bad. It's a sign of sin. If you never sinned, you wouldn't be born. You sinned in your previous lives, therefore you are born. Even if you are born a Brahmin. But if you are born a Brahmin, you have all the weaknesses of a body. You eat and you sleep, you do all what a body has to do. Therefore, it's not a good thing. Once I gave Mr. Mukherjee a Kader dhoti, you know, the things that you wrap yourself in, the equivalent of a sari for a Bengali. I never saw Mr. Mukherjee in a pair of trousers dressed in the European style. He always wore Bengali dhoti. I gave him a dhoti for his birthday. He refused it. He said, give me that at the time of the festival of Goddess Durga. That's all right. But my birthday, I don't celebrate. But what did I say? I came into this world, I want to get away from it. I want to go back to my utmost part of myself, that's the divine spark, should merge into the ocean of divinity, that is to say, the soul of the universe. And I don't want to be an individual any longer. Individuality is a prison. Therefore, I act. He acted all right. I act, but I act with it. I try to act with this detachment. And that is the detachment, yoga, karma yoga. And I forgot about the karma yoga business. I didn't do it any longer. I was told not to do it. I was told that karma yoga was my line. I had to do what I can for what I love, but do it with detachment. That is to say, I should not have felt upset in 1945. I did, of course. But I should have felt. This was necessary, it had to happen. I should have felt different. I couldn't feel it. I was not advanced enough to feel that. Many few people were. Then 45 came. 46. End of 45, as it was, I said already, I went to Europe. In October 46, I was staying on 104 Grosvenor Road in a very quiet room. It was a building for nurses, kind of hostel for nurses. They used to sleep in the daytime. At night they were doing duty. So it was perfectly quiet in the daytime and at night. And that's what I wanted. I like physical peace. So I was there. In the night of the 15th to the 16th of October, 46. And I never read the papers. I didn't want to read them. I didn't want to see the evolution of the trial of Nuremberg. I hated it. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't detach my mind from the fact that I knew, without reading the papers, everybody knew it, that the 11 were to be killed on that night. I was thinking. And then suddenly, I was not asleep. But I felt exactly as I used to feel after my exercises of Hatha Yoga, 10 years before. I was no longer in that room. I don't know how I went through the walls. I was in the Göring's cell. And I saw Göring just as I do see you. He was he was seated with his hands like this. And suddenly he did like that, as though he saw me and was rather astonished. And I said to him, I had something in my hand, something in my right hand, tiny little piece of, I don't know what, something I had. I told him, I said, no fear, keine Angst, no fear. I'm not an enemy. I'm one of your people. I wish I could save you all from this ignominy. But unfortunately, the heavenly powers gave me permission to save one and one only, to my choice. And I chose you because of your kindness to creatures, because of your solicitude to animals. Göring had been a hunter in his youth. He had given it up. And he liked animals, that's true. But some hunters do, in fact. When he lived during the time, they're hunters. He had a leopard, a red pet. The leopard used to lie at his feet and purr like a big cat. I knew that. What I knew also was that he contributed with the Führer to the setting up of the Reichsjagdgesetz, a book thick like that, that is much more than a regulation of hunting. It's a protection of nature. Traps are forbidden. Hunting one man by himself is forbidden. There must be two. If an animal is wounded, irrecuperably wounded, the other one must kill it, shoot it. Mustn't kill females. And say, mustn't. The Führer could not forbid hunting altogether. He did what he could to lessen the effects of it. And Göring had a part to that. That I knew before I got into this kind of queer state. I said to him thereafter, I said, take this. I gave him what I had in my right hand. I said, take this and don't allow these people to kill you as a criminal. You are not one. Anything but. Now I must go. Goodbye. Heilika. And I vanished. And I didn't see anything of the kind. I felt completely unconscious after that. I saw Göring and I was unconscious. I gave him whatever I went to give him. I was unconscious. I woke up at about 10 o'clock in the morning. I never wake up. I wake up at 6. I never sleep like that. I rubbed my eyes. I said, what a queer experience I had. Where did I go this evening, last night? Anyway, I bathed quickly and I went downstairs. It was a rainy day, drizzling. I never bought a paper, as I told you. I wasn't going to buy a paper on the 16th of October, anything but. But I couldn't help seeing the headlines of the papers. There was a newspaper kiosk just opposite. Headlines like that, 8 centimeters high. Göring found dead in his cell, that was during the night and morning. Nobody knows who gave him the poison, potassium cyanide. Nobody knows who gave it to him. And I felt cold all over my body. It seemed to me that I saw the Nataraj, the dancing Siva, as you present them in Hindu temples, dancing in the clouds. And I said, if this has been done through me, use me in greater things still. If it's me, it's the best thing I did in my life. That's what I felt. I don't know what really happened to this day. I know what experience I had, I know what I felt, I know what I saw, I don't know anything more. Is it a genuine experience? What is it? I just don't. I don't pretend to know, and I don't want to speak of what I don't know. In June, 6th of June, 48, when I met Sven Hedin, less than two years later, I asked Sven Hedin, who is a scholar in Tibetology, and has roamed all over Central Asia, and seen things in Ladakh and Tibet. I asked him, what would people in Ladakh or Tibet think of this? He said, my dear, they would find that the most natural thing in the world. That is no problem for a Tibet or for a Ladakhi. For a Lamaist, Buddhist, no problem at all. You went in astral, you gave Göring some astral potassium cyanide, and it materialized in his hand. He took it and died, instead of being hanged. I said, I wish I could have done it for the 11. Well, you could for one. Be thankful that you could for one. So that's what Sven Hedin told me. I don't know any more than that. I never had an experience, a psychic experience in my life. It's the only one. I'm not a strong believer in anything that I cannot either see or prove with my own strength. I just take it as an hypothesis, as a theory, if you like. But I do think that of the many, many theories that have been put forward to explain the unexplainable, it is the most plausible. It is at least the one that can be, for our national socialism, the best exploited. I told you of Kudira, didn't I? Telling me that he was a Sudra, and even if he was still a Sudra under the new order, it wouldn't matter to him, because he became a Sudra, he was born in a Sudra family, because of his past sins in past lives. And he said, well, whatever I am, in the new order, I believe in the new order because it's true. Well, true or not, I don't know. But I know that if we had this kind of belief in Europe, and if a European of more or less pure Aryan descent, could think, if I'm good in this life, and if I stay good in my future lives for another 500 years, I might become a German. What a good, lovely thing it would be. Or I might become a Swede, I wouldn't say Swede like certain Swedes are today, because they are not perfectly of Aryan behavior, all somehow take drugs and do what, I don't know what. But a Swede, an ideal Swede, an ideal Nordic European, I'll become that one day. Before I get liberated completely, it would be a very good way of preparation to be a sort of good propaganda. It's better propaganda than what we get in Christianity. Heaven and hell. And of course, hell if you don't believe in the church. Here we can believe in whatever you like. There's no common belief among Hindus. One Hindu doesn't believe in any god at all. He's a perfect atheist, materialist if you like. Another Hindu believes in one god. Another believes in 33 million gods. Another one believes in a couple, God and Shakti, God and consort. In fact, every god in Hinduism has a consort, meaning that there are two aspects of energy, the positive and the negative. Well, scientists know that. Electricity, negative and positive. That's what it means, in fact. It comes down to science. There's a book recently published, and I want to read it. The Greek consul, Greek ambassador here, told me he would lend it to me. It's his, but he has lent it to somebody else. It is called Tao and Modern Physics. I'd love to read that. In fact, the idea of the expanding universe that modern physicists believe in, and the contracting universe, that you get in Hinduism. Not after each Manavantara, each succession of four ages, but after several successions of four ages. That is, a time comes when the universe expands, and goes very, very, becomes very wide. And the time comes again when it's absolutely, comes to nothing. It's very heavy. The whole universe is extremely heavy, and it has hardly any volume. And it begins again. That's creation and destruction. That's the explanation of creation and destruction by the old Hindu sage. Now, I must tell you something that I recently read this morning. I have a French friend, but she could be my daughter, according to Indian standards, even my granddaughter. She's much younger than I, 38. And she's now in the south at her guru's. She has a guru. Or rather, the disciple of a dead guru, because our guru is dead. And she was visiting the ashram of the famous Ramana Maharishi. Ramana Maharishi is really the greatest, or perhaps one of the greatest, one or second of the two or three greatest sages of modern India. An extraordinary man. He did not teach. He taught only through his radiation. He was perfectly silent. He was vowed to perfect silence. It's a very queer thing to say, but he did teach like that. I know people who saw him and who said, if silence can have meaning, that man shows it. Anyhow, he used to speak sometimes, of course, not silent completely. This woman asked his shishya, his disciple, what did Ramana Maharishi say about Adolf Hitler? Did he ever mention him? And the disciple answered, yes, he considered him as a gnani. A gnani is something extremely high. A gnani and a rishi are the same thing, or practically the same thing. The Sanskrit words. Gnani has the same root as gnos, the Christian sect, the Gnostics, the people of knowledge. A gnani means a man that has complete knowledge, that knows everything. Infused knowledge, intuitive knowledge, if you like. He is divine through his intuition. Like God, he knows everything through intuition. Well, I was extremely pleased to hear that said by a very great rishi, very great Indian sage, about our Führer. It's not what you have in Europe. Here in India, nobody says anything against them, except people that are brainwashed by European radios. Apart from that, the masses of India don't care. It's something foreign. They have their own little small, petty lives to think of, and their poverty and their struggle for day to day. The intellectual Indian either likes them very much. My landlord likes them very much. My landlord's son likes them very much. Or else, he has an idea like this. Well, Satyananda Swami, the head of the Hindu mission, the founder and head of the Hindu mission, for which I worked for years, fighting communism, fighting any religion of equality, and especially the Christian missionaries, in the name of Hindu tradition. That Satyananda Swami used to say, Adolf Hitler is the reincarnation of the god Vishnu. Vishnu is the aspect of God, the Trinity, the Hindu Trinity, the aspect of the Trinity that goes to keep things from rushing to destruction, to keep them back, to go against time. Time is destruction. You have to destroy in order to create again. But there are forces that try to postpone destruction. And he said he was an incarnation of that force. Well, he was. But it's a nice thing to hear, a very refreshing thing to hear from a Hindu sage. When I told him, I said, I came here because I'm really a pagan, a worshipper of the sun, and I believe in the pagan reaction of Emperor Julian. Emperor Julian was my second great love, my first one being Alexander the Great, when I was a child, an adolescent. And I came to India to forget, if possible, a sort of tropical equivalent of what we had in Europe before Christianity. And I'm not a disciple of any Indian, I'm a disciple of Adolf Hitler. He said, good, Adolf Hitler is as much a Hindu as any of our Hindus. He's an incarnation of God Vishnu. There you are. It was extremely surprising and refreshing to hear that in 1936. And he said it during the wartime too. In Kumilal, he gave a speech. When was that? In 1942. He openly said, what we need here in India, everywhere in the world, is National Socialism. He openly said so. And I said to him, Satyananda Swami, you'll get into trouble one day with the British police. He said, well, I couldn't care less if I did. I told him the truth. In fact, in the Hinduism, is for the Aryans of India, a means to be able, according to tradition, the Aryans should rule here. They don't, because tradition has been abandoned for years and years and years. India is going away from tradition, like the whole world. We are in the dark age, and India is going to the dogs, and the whole world is going to the dogs. Except a minority that are fighting against time, against the current of time. And I hope that we'll win. We will have to win. We can't help winning. But I don't know whether we'll win. Just now, when if the Avenger Kalki, as the Hindus call him, is going to come very soon, or whether it's going to come in centuries, because centuries are also very soon in the infinity of time. A century is nothing, and 10 centuries are nothing. In fact, I feel that myself. When I feel the struggle for Christianity to master Europe, that is 1500 years ago, I resent it as though it was now. I feel the struggle of Witukin as though it was now. That's it. Well, the Jew originally was not different from other Semitic people. He was just as good as they are. I have absolutely nothing against him. I mean, say the real Jew, antiquity. He believed in a god of his own. And he didn't look twice, didn't think of it twice in praying or sacrificing to the gods of other people. You get that in the Bible. Again and again and again in the Bible you have examples of Jewish kings. They are called bad in the Bible, of course. They're called bad. Jewish kings sacrificing to gods of Syria, to Astarte, to Derketo, to the different Baalims. Baal means God in Hebrew or in the Syrian religions. There were heaps of them. And the average Jew had no scruples about that. Only Moses and the prophets are the ones who made the Jews what they are. Really, what distinguishes the Jews from other people of antiquity is the intolerance that was given to them through the Mosaic Law and through that command of the Deuteronomy. People you come in touch with and people that your God will give into your hands, don't spare them. Don't make friends with them. Destroy them. Destroy whatever opposes you. That is a thing, a new thing. And most of the Jews didn't stick to it. So many times you get in the Bible, they are a hard-necked people. They will whore after other deities. And they did whore after other deities. Take the story of the king Manasseh. He erected altars to all the host of stars in heaven and bowed his head down to them. He worshipped the stars. Well, everybody did the same in those days. And worse than that, you get especially in the 6th and 7th century, 7th and 6th century, 8 BC. And excavations give you that. Heaps of children's ashes in Palestine. It was the custom among the Semitic people to sacrifice their firstborn. By far, an awful thing, I don't approve of it. I wouldn't say I wouldn't do the same. But the Carthaginians, the Tyrians, the Sidonians, all these people did it. The Jews that were one of them, they did the same. And God, of course, was angry. Jehovah was angry. Because that this was not the orders of Jehovah. They had to be different from the other people. They haven't got to do what the others did. But you get heaps of these places. And there's one awful place, south of Jerusalem, called Gehinnom, it became Gehenna, the hell. It's the original word for Gehenna, the hell. Hell because I suppose it must be awful when you passed nearby. If there were sacrifices, you must have heard the screaming and the smell of the body. It must have been awful, real. But the Jew has become what he is now and become that through Moses and through the prophets. Through the prophets that wanted to make them as different people. And the prophets who were extremely resentful of any other people that opposed the Jews. You only have to read in the Bible the prophet Nahum. Nahum, when he hears of the fall of Nineveh in August 612 BC, he is rolling with pleasure. Oh, to the bloody city, he says. She's punished now. She's fallen. And what did he hear? He probably didn't hear it at once because there was no radio in those days, but perhaps 3 months later, after the fall, he heard that Nabopolassar of Babylon and his son, young Nebuchadnezzar, who was then 17, stormed Nineveh, set it on fire. He was pleased. The Jew, I have nothing against him as long as he stays in his place. That is to say, as long as he's a Jewish nationalist. Jewish nationalist, proud of his race, all right, I'm proud of mine. The Negro should be proud of his too. Every creature should be proud of his what he is. But I resented them. And what is the sign of the Dark Ages is that they are used for the purpose of this Dark Age, of deracializing everybody. What I resent in the Jew is not that he's proud of being a Jew. All right. I can have a cup of tea with him, and he'll talk of his pride, and I don't mind that. But when he starts telling me that I must consider race as nothing, I must be an internationalist and an interracialist, well, he is not. What I resent is this. When the Nuremberg Laws, 15th of September 1935, were promulgated in Nuremberg, interdiction of any Aryan marrying a non-Aryan, and especially a Jew. The Jews are allowed in Germany as guests only. They are not allowed to raise the Reich's flag, the flag of Germany. But if they like to raise the flag, their own flag, the flag of Israel, that was not existing yet, but it was existing among themselves. They had a flag of their own. He can raise his own flag, the Jew in Germany. And if people object, if the neighbors object, they will have to deal with the German police. German police will protect the Jew against the public opinion. He can raise his own flag, but not the German. He is not a German. People, when they heard that in the whole world, I was in Calcutta at the time, they raised hell. Oh, awful racialism. Look at the tyrant, Hitler, persecuting the Jews. He wasn't persecuting them at all. He was giving them what should be given to them, and that's all. They are foreigners in Germany. They have the right to be proud of their foreign origin, and they have not the right to be called themselves Germans. They are not Germans.